Hello. 1977 was a transitional year for the New York Mets. And by transitional, I mean terrible. The Mets, of course, had been historically bad their first 6 seasons in the National League, 1962 through 1967, finishing last place in 5 of those 6 years, and in ninth place, second to last, in the other year. Starting in 1968, the Mets began to achieve respectability. In 1969, they won the World Series. 1973, they made the World Series again, falling short in the full 7 games against the Oakland A's. And between 1974 and 1976, with the last remaining core of the great players who had gotten them to the World Series in 69 and 73, the Mets continued to be competitive. But change was afoot in baseball in the mid-1970s with the advent of free agency. Mets ownership at this time was frugal, which is one way to put it. They did not want to play the free agent market. The crosstown New York Yankees had spent almost $3 million to sign Reggie Jackson as a free agent. Reggie's bat and leadership helped the Yankees achieve World Series runs in 1977. And 1978 and 1981, with another playoff appearance, albeit unsuccessful in 1980, the Yankees were playoff teams 4 of Reggie Jackson's 5 years in pinstripes. The Mets, of course, were not doing that. And in fact, Mets ownership tried to shortchange the best player the Mets ever had, Tom Seaver, who was hoping for a contract bump in order to befit his status as pretty much the best pitcher in baseball. The Mets planted stories in the press, negative stories, about Tom Seaver the first 2.5 months of the 1977, accusing him of being greedy, which is really projection, if you think about it. And on June 15th, 1977, with the Mets mired in last place, the Mets front office engineered what came to be called the Midnight Massacre. Tom Seaver, whose nickname was the Franchise, that's how important he was to the Mets, was traded away to the Cincinnati Reds, who were coming off back-to-back World Series championships in 1975 and 1976. The Mets got 4 players back for Tom Seaver, and each of the 4 players they got back had relative degrees of merit. Pat Zachary had been Rookie of the year before, 1976. Steve Henderson would be a very good outfielder in the major leagues for more than another 10 years. Doug Flynn, although he could not hit, was a very highly regarded fielder, and in fact became the second ever Met to win the Gold Glove Fielding Award in 1980. The fourth player, Dan Norman, was a minor leaguer who never really panned out as a prospect, but these things happen. The Mets were hoping to say that 4 for 1, trading away Tom Seaver, was a good deal, but it was not. They were much better players in the Reds' farm system the Mets could have gotten had they bothered to do their scouting rather than just offload him for the first set of players the Reds offered. Tom Seaver led the Reds to the playoffs in 1979 and achieved very good things with them, but the Mets were bereft and would remain a last place or second to last place team for the next 7 years after the trade. And then, on July 13th, 1977, the Tom Seaverless New York Mets were at home at Shea Stadium in Queens, New York, to play the Chicago Cubs. As was usual for the Mets at this time, they just could not hit. And even though their best remaining pitcher, Jerry Kuzman, was pitching for the Mets only managed to score 1 run through the first 5 innings. Down 2-1 in the bottom of the sixth inning, the Mets sent their leadoff man, Lenny Randle, up to bat against Chicago Cubs pitcher Ray Burris. And that is when the lights went out at Shea Stadium, in all of Queens, in all of New York City, and the lights would stay out for a very, very long time.
Direction point. Direction Point.
A Doctor Who podcast network.
Well, hi, everybody. Welcome back to Doctor Who Literature, the podcast taking you through the world of the Doctor Who novelizations put out by Target Books from 1973 onward, in publication order. We're a member of the Direction Point Doctor Who podcast network. My name is Jason, and I'm your host on this journey, this very long journey. Looking ahead from July 1977, we are in the Target Books in the middle of 1985, and on the real calendar, it is November 2023, the month that Doctor Who turns 60 years of age. Many big things have happened in the Doctor Who world over the last week. We have learned that the Doctor Who media presence is now being rebranded the Hooniverse. If you live in the UK and pay a BBC license fee, you now have access pretty much to the entirety of Doctor Who through iPlayer. I suppose if you live overseas and have a VPN, you also have access to the same thing. This week was dropped Tales from the TARDIS, a series of vignettes featuring many classic series companions and doctors in new stories tied into classic Doctor Who stories that you can watch on iPlayer. It is a very good time to be a Doctor Who fan. The next three episodes will release on a weekly basis, starting on November 25th, on iPlayer in the UK, and on Disney Plus in most of the rest of the world. As Doctor Who turns 60 years of age, we are taking a break from the novelizations for the next 4 weeks. We will bring you a variety of episodes celebrating different aspects of the Doctor Who universe over the last 60 years. This week, tying in to the intro about the 1977 Mets and the infamous New York City blackout, we have with us the author of the novel Darkness on the Edge of Town, a Stranger Things novel about Detective Hopper when he was still a New York City detective before returning to Hawkins, Indiana, and what he was doing the night of the blackout. It is an excellent novel. It is one of the best novels that I've read for making use of New York City in the science fiction genre. The author of that book, Adam Christopher, is from New Zealand, not a native New Yorker, which surprised the heck out of me. That's how good the New York geography and history and lore is in Darkness on the Edge of Town. Adam has also written several other books in the elementary Sherlock Holmes universe, and a best-selling Star Wars novel, Shadow of the Sith. Adam joins us today. We're going to talk about his Doctor Who fandom. We are going to talk about his favorite Doctor Who story or stories of all time. We are going to talk about his many excellent novels, including the Star Wars, the Stranger Things, and others. It was an excellent conversation. Really enjoyed talking to Adam, and I cannot wait to share the conversation with you. First, however, as a brief interlude, continuing on with our series of talking to Doctor Who authors and podcasters and fans about their favorite Doctor Who stories of all time, this week I also recorded a Trap 1 episode with Mark and with Brendan from Flight Through Entirety, talking about the most recently released Doctor Who novel, tying into the Doomsday multimedia platform event. That novel is called Extraction Point by M.G. Harris. I will put a link to that Trap 1 episode in the show notes, as it just released a couple of days ago. But after recording that episode, I had the pleasure of sitting down with Brendan and Mark and asking them, guys, what is your favorite Doctor Who story of all time? And the answer sounded a little something like this. As Doctor Who literature continues on with its 60th anniversary month, I am asking everybody, what is their favorite Doctor Who serial of all time over the last 60 years? This has led to some awkward encounters at the supermarket when you ask the 17-year-old cashier, what's your favorite Doctor Who story of all time? And you get a blank look. But I am now in friendly company. I am sitting here with Brendan from Flight Through Entirety and Mark from Trap One. I want to ask each of you guys, what is your favorite Doctor Who episode, TV episode of all time, from the first 60 years of the program, Unearthly Child, all the way through The Power of the Doctor, and why? Starting with you, Brendan.
Okie dokie. So, I've given this answer before on FTE and other shows. It hasn't changed. It is The Androids of Tara.
Ooh.
And there are many reasons I love it. It was one of the stories that wasn't in the initial batch my dad had taped, which I watched in the late 80s, so I had to wait till the early 90s to see it, a few extra years. So it already had an air of mystery around it. And then when it came along, I loved Romana as a kid, the first Romana, and I still do, and she's pushed the front of this story and has a lot more to do in it. It's also so atypical because it is Doctor Who as fairy tale. There are, of course, technological elements with the androids and the charged swords and what have you, but everything works by a sort of fairy tale logic within the story, including why we have this technology, but we have this feudal culture. And there are just so many great moments in it. Like Romana gets sort of her first signs of empathy and humanity with other people. And the Doctor, of course, his whole temperament in the story is kind of defined by a moment early on, which is actually something that Tom Baker came up with when he's offered money, he haggles by going lower. instead of higher. And in the newer novelization by David Fisher, David Fisher retains the Doctor going higher, and the Doctor's just having a bit of fun with that. But Tom on the set said, actually, no, the Doctor doesn't care about money, so he's going to play the game. And it's just this moment of he's a gentleman, and that brilliant sword fight at the end where the Doctor's being a buffoon and then finally sees the weakness and goes for it. You've got Peter Jeffrey as an amazing villain. You've got Neville Jason and Simon Lack and Madame Lamia. Just all the supporting cast are amazing, and everyone pitches it perfectly. And it's just a perfect sort of summer day episode. And so, Androids of Tara.
I have had a lot of Tom Baker stories show up when I asked this question of everybody over the last few months. I have not heard Androids of Tara before. I've had two votes for Talons of Wang Chiang, and I've had two votes for City of Death. Androids of Tara is a great choice for all the reasons you mentioned. It's a very underrated story, and it's atypical for Doctor Who, but boy, is it enjoyable to watch. Mark, how about you? I suspect that your answer is going to be Silver Nemesis, but I'm curious to see if I'm wrong.
It's a tricky one, isn't it? Because it's one of those things, and I think some of your other guests have said this, it depends on the day of the week and your mood and everything. I'm tempted to say Silver Nemesis because Happiness Patrol was the first story I ever saw, and I loved it, and I was immediately hooked. And the day we're recording is the 35th anniversary of the broadcast of episode one of the Happiness Patrol. So, yeah, kind of feeling really nostalgic for the Happiness Patrol today. But I think it was Silver Nemesis that made me a fan because it's such a brilliant, propulsive, funny, amazing story. Then the first VHS I ever got was Death to the Daleks, which I absolutely loved as well. It was my first Dalek story, and I loved it, and I loved the Third Doctor and Sarah Jane Smith. But the second VHS I got was the Five Doctors, and that really opened up the rest of classic Doctor Who for me. It was, you know, it was the first time I'd seen any of the other Doctors apart from McCoy and Pertwee. And that was the video I watched again and again and again as a kid and kind of know it word for word and absolutely love it. And then in September, I went to my first BFI screening and it was the Five Doctors. And it was just such a fantastic day because I'd never watched really Doctor Who in that kind of communal atmosphere before. I managed to go to the Doctor Who, the big 50th celebration at Excel, and then not get a ticket for the Day of the Doctor, which I imagine was an amazing atmosphere, kind of watching the Day of the Doctor with a load of other fans. But so this is the first time I'd have watched it basically in a big kind of screen like that, and saw Conrad and Cy and Pete, my fellow Trap One hosts, and it was just a fantastic day. So I'm feeling very, very warm towards the Five Doctors at the moment, and have been since then, which has been, you know, since I saw it when I was about 9 or 10. So I'm going to say it's probably a really predictable answer that you'll get loads of, but the Five Doctors is just brilliant. It hit me at the right time as a kid, as a showcase of the monsters and the doctors and the companions and the master and everything. It's a brilliant, brilliant story.
It's funny that you mention that, because every Doctor Who story and novelization gets exactly one episode of Doctor Who literature to stand in the spotlight, whether that's a great story like Pyramids of Mars or whether it's The Dominators, Hi Fraser. But I devoted not one, not two, not four, but three episodes to The Five Doctors, exploring the theme, is this the greatest Doctor Who story of all time? And I had everybody... I had multiple guests across the three episodes, including the wife of Peter Davison, Elizabeth Morton, who had some stories from the Five Doctors as well.
Wow.
I don't know if everybody that I spoke to believes that Five Doctors is the greatest of all time, but it took three episodes to discuss. I think, even though it's not number one on my own personal list, which I'll be unveiling shortly, I think there's an argument to be made that it is the greatest of all time, because it's a Terrence Dix script and it has something meaningful to do for every cast member, and the cameos are great, and even the cameos propel the story forward. And then you have this epic conclusion, 20 minutes in the Tomb of Rassilon, which just has great twists and turns. It is Terrence at his absolute storytelling peak. Every line of dialogue is quotable. If you give anybody a verbal cue from the Five Doctors who's been a Doctor Who fan for more than a minute, they can probably give you the next 10 lines of dialogue after that with the exact cadence and inflection of the original actors. And I dare you to give me the first 10 digits of pi not doing your best Richard Herndahl impression. So you're the first person to actually give the Five Doctors as the answer, but
hey.
We've discussed it on the show at length. I think you are both 100% right, even though your answers are different. All right, Mark, Brendan, thank you so much.
Thank you, Jason.
Thank you.
And my thanks again to Brendan from Flight Through Entirety and Mark from Trap One for sitting down and talking to me as well. What we're going to do now is, after another trailer from the world of Direction Point, we'll play my interview with Adam Christopher, longtime Doctor Who fan, best-selling author. Let's get to it.
Hello, fellow time travelers, and welcome to the Doctor Who Target Book Club podcast, the only podcast to discuss, in story order, all the Doctor Who novelizations. My name is Tony Whitt, and every 2 weeks or so, I'm joined by a 2 to 3 person discussion panel, including our so-called expert who's been a Who fan since 1979. That would be me. We also get the views of intermediate, casual, and novice fans who either have never seen the show or who have never read these books until these podcasts, including
Dalton Hughes
and
Alison Fitz-Seyfried.
You can find us on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you find good podcasts, or even ones like ours. You're listening to the Doctor Who Literature Podcast. Enjoy your travels.
And welcome back to a very special episode of Doctor Who Literature. I am excited to have with me a longtime Doctor Who fan and a New York Times best-selling author. And we're going to talk about some of his books and whether or not Doctor Who references are contained within those books. Adam Christopher, welcome to the show.
Hello, thank you very much for having me.
Very excited to talk, and we have a lot to discuss today. But I see behind you a lot of interesting photos. I see the Star Wars logo. I see some art, whereas I am sitting in a 1960s-style kitchen with wooden cabinets and a green porcelain sink. So let's talk about your background, because my background is not very much to discuss.
Sure. Where to start?
Let's start with your fandom journey. When and where did you first become a Doctor Who fan?
So this was, I'm from New Zealand, and it was 1985. In fact, it was April 1985. TVNZ, which was kind of the main broadcaster in New Zealand, started, you probably heard this from other guests actually, but they started this big repeat season with the Mind Robber and the Crotons, and then everything from Spearhead from Space through to Survival. So my parents had watched Doctor Who before, and because I liked science fiction, and I was kind of like 8 years old, and I think 8 years old, 7 years old. I liked science fiction and fantasy and that kind of thing, and they thought that this program would be something I liked. So they kind of sat me down on a Friday night and we watched, I mean, it was the Mind Robber, and I was kind of hooked. It's kind of so weird when I think about it. Like, I can put it down to an exact time and date where I saw my first episode. It's been with me my whole life since then. You know, this repeat season, which was the two Charlatans and then everything from Spearhead, this is kind of weird because I'm, from a UK point of view, because I live in the UK now, but like I'm 10 years out of date because I was growing up at exactly the right age for Doctor Who, but I was watching Jon Pertwee because New Zealand television was just generally kind of behind the rest of the world in those days. So it was like primetime Jon Pertwee, which is kind of weird because I'm, as I said, I'm the wrong age for Jon Pertwee, but I'm the right age for Doctor Who. So that was fun.
It's funny you mentioned that because growing up on the other side of the international dateline in New York, I also became a fan of the show end of 1984, beginning of 1985. And living in New York City, Doctor Who here was aired on PBS, which is a network of local public television stations. I had access to 6 different PBS stations on my cable network, so I could watch different eras of the Doctor on different days of the week. I was watching Jon Pertwee starting in early 1985, at much the same time that you were. And in fact, on this show, we are in the middle of the 1985 season of Target novelizations. A few weeks ago, I had Paul Scoones on the show, also from New Zealand.
Right. Adam, yeah, of course.
Talking about the February 1985 book, The Caves of Androzani. So everything is coming together. This is a 1985 podcast right now, and you and I both became fans in that wonderful year.
Excellent. Good to hear.
When did you join fandom? Because I understand you did a lot of fanzine work for TSV.
Yes. Which was started by Paul Scoones, a good friend of mine, and you've had him on the show. While watching Doctor Who from 85 onwards, I started writing basically Doctor Who fan fiction because... And maybe this was unusual because maybe my teacher at school was a kind of failed novelist who had ambitions that never went anywhere. But at 7 years old, we were writing our own stories every day after lunch. And what I was writing, I've still got some of the books from that period. It's like, it's basically my version of what was on TV that week. So I can pinpoint episodes like Ambassadors of Death, Spirit from Space, Claws of Exos, like very clearly just a mashup of my own version of these stories. But that kind of kept me, I mean, this is pre-fandom, obviously, my own fandom, but like that's what ultimately got me involved with Doctor Who fandom because a few years later, and I think 1990, this friend at school was wearing a badge, and it was a New Zealand Doctor Who fan club badge. And I had no idea that such things existed. And as it happened that weekend, there was we used to call them video marathons because sort of 1990, the official video releases were not, it started, but there wasn't many things available. And what people in New Zealand did, kind of the more organized fandom, was have pen pals in the UK and kind of could swap videotapes. So if you were very lucky and you knew the right people, then you had access to episodes which had never been repeated or broadcast again and were like super rare, kind of gold dust. And we used to organize, well, before I got involved, they used to organize these kind of weekend Saturday video marathons where you'd go, you'd hire out a church hall and you'd go and watch four episodes of The Ice Warriors, complete with time code across it because it was some dodgy pirate copy from someone's contact. Or, I mean, it sounds ridiculous, you know, stuff which is now instantly available to us. But then was just impossible. Like the censor rights, like a copy of the censor rights, it was so bad, you could hardly make out what was going on because it was, you know, 10th generation copy of a copy of a copy. But that was kind of my first foray into kind of, oh, there's actually other people that like Doctor Who. And not only do they kind of organize themselves and have these kind of meetings, but there's fanzines. And again, TSV, which is the New Zealand Doctor Who fan club fanzine, this again sounds like ancient history. It was, you know, black and white, photocopied A5 amateur magazine, came out, you know, a few times a year, painstakingly done by hand, typeset, letter set, because this, again, this is before kind of desktop publishing and home computing was made it so easy. So I started getting TSV. And eventually, later on, TSV became kind of the first place where my Doctor Who fan fiction was kind of published because they always did short stories or flash fiction and things. So I started then, I was then exposed to other people writing Doctor Who fiction, which then kind of motivated me to keep doing my own. And yeah, eventually wrote loads of, I mean, I did other things like reviews, video reviews or TV reviews or like articles and things. Because it was a really close-knit community because, again, pre-internet, it was all pen pals and mailing lists and things like Doctor Who magazine and news and new stuff from the UK was either extremely expensive to get in New Zealand, like if, you know, no one could afford a Doctor Who magazine subscription, or super out of date. So Doctor Who magazine would arrive 6 months after it came out. So things like TSV were like really the kind of hub of fandom and news and information, and also helped to encourage me to kind of do my writing, which is where I kind of started. Eventually, I actually ended up editing TSV, because obviously over the years I became good friends with Paul Skoons, who founded it, and then kind of edited it and the fan club was a separate thing, and then they kind of amalgamated. But eventually, because I was kind of interested in publishing and design and layout and things, I kind of started helping out and eventually edited it. I think I did, I don't know, 7 issues at the end. Yeah, and I won awards, and it was all kind of cool. But like by that point, by the time I finished, I moved to the UK, and like fanzines were kind of, you know, dying out because of the internet and everything. I know fanzines kind of still exist, but they're like, they're very professional, and also they're very specialized on a specific topic. Like there's some amazing Doctor Who fanzines or Blake 7 fanzines and things, but they're very specific and polished. Whereas TSV was really like a Doctor Who magazine because it had news and reviews and information and, you know, short fiction and interviews. But yeah, it was good fun. Like to me, like talking about it now, it sounds like so long ago. And you know, that's another age.
You and I are both from the 1970s. I was born during the production of Invasion of the Dinosaurs, and you come along a short handful of years after that. You and I grew up in an era where fanzines are put together by X-Acto knife, and yes, we are watching nth generation time code copies of stories. The first time that I got Underwater Menace Part 3 on an nth generation VHS cassette, you could barely see the screen because of the wavy lines. You could barely hear the dialogue. And you have this warm glow because you're watching, oh my goodness, it's Underwater Menace, the worst story of all time. But you couldn't hear anything. And it turns out once you clear away the interference, it's much better than that. But we're in a prehistoric age, so we don't know. And now, this is literally the week that the Hooniverse debuts on BBC iPlayer. You could now go to iPlayer and watch or hear literally any extant or missing story right now. It would take you 45 seconds to get there. And everything is instantaneous, and there's really no more need for this sort of fan club culture that you and I both grew up in. So our fandom experience is quite different to someone 13 years old starting today.
Absolutely. I remember talking to Paul Skerns about it. You know, at the peak of the Doctor Who fan club in New Zealand, I think it had about 250 members. This was maybe mid-90s. And he kind of pointed out, it's like, well, you know, with the new series, perhaps a few years ago when it was more at its height of popularity, you go to a local shopping mall and there's more than 250 people who have watched the last episode. It's a completely different thing. And yeah, we I don't know, we sound so old.
Nonsense, you're a swinger, to quote Sarah Jane in Robot. When my daughter was 3 years old, you could walk into Barnes & Noble, the big bookstore chain here, and they would have an entire table of Doctor Who merchandise. This was during the Moffat era. And I've got video of my three-year-old squeezing a plush Dalek that says, exterminate when you squeeze it. Yeah. This is not something that would have happened when I was 3 years old, for sure.
No, yeah.
But as we're talking about the 60th anniversary, let me ask you what I've been asking all my recent guests. Considering the entire run of Televised 2, 1963 to 2022, and the very next episode comes out in 3 weeks, what is your favorite TV story of all time?
I have two which are equal, and that's a kind of it's a cop out answer, but this is something that I'm a good Doctor Who fan. I rigorously debate such questions with myself almost every day. I make lists, I make spreadsheets, I compare episodes, because this is what a dedicated fan does. So I'm not just kind of saying I've got two, but it's got to be Marco Polo and the Silurians, which are kind of completely different kind of stories. Marco Polo doesn't even exist anymore. But the Silurians, for me, is the most adult Doctor Who story ever made. And it's kind of weird because it comes in right in as a second color story. So they've had this big relaunch in 1970 for a new audience, and it's exciting, and it's action, and it's a color. If you had a color TV, which actually very few people did have, but and then the Silurians comes along, and it's kind of this long 7-episode, very political. It's got a mystery. It's a thriller. It's got some amazing direction. Some parts of it like a Hammer horror movie. Some parts of it are like a kind of weird political boardroom drama. And it's kind of staggering that they actually made it. It's just so unlike any other Doctor Who story. I mean, season 7 itself was quite kind of adult in tone and theme. So it fits within season 7. So, you know, Spirit from Space, Silurians, Ambassador, Death, Inferno. Of those four, it's the most talky and deep and complex, even when it has the classic man in a rubber suit monster kind of thing. So it's just hilarious. It's just something about it. It's, yeah. Marco Polo is, I mean, it's a Hartnell historical, the original first TARDIS crew that we see, Ian, Barbara, Susan, Doctor. But again, it's unusual. Like, unlike other historicals, what we really see is, and it's, again, it's 7 episodes, it's these kind of snapshots of a journey, because the whole adventure takes place over months and months, which is unlike, I think, nearly every other Doctor Who story. And we're only getting 7 25-minute episodes. So really what we're seeing are these kind of excerpts of this big road trip, I guess, which makes the whole pace of it and the whole scope of the story way huger than what you see on screen, which is what I love about it. So like you're watching this thing and you know that it's part of a much bigger kind of story, which I love. And also, like, it's John Lucarotti who also wrote The Aztecs, which is probably my second favorite story. He, you know, his writing is just really good. And again, that first season of Doctor Who for me is probably Doctor Who at its peak, where it was experimental and a bit educational, and they were pushing the boundaries of what basically children's television could do in 1963. And it's a shame that Marco Polo doesn't exist. Like, there's really good reconstructions, and in fact, there's a good one. There's recons in black and white and color, because it's one of those stories where they took so many color photos during costume rehearsal that you can actually do quite a good kind of, you know, color recon. But yeah, those are my two.
What I love about your answers are two different things. Actually, three, because number one, you're like me and you debate and you make lists. And I actually did my full top 60 all-time list recently. And that'll be coming 60. Up in a special episode later this month. Because 60th anniversary, I needed to do 60 for 60. And that's one thing. Second thing is, both of the stories that you picked are classic series stories. So far, every single guest that I have asked that question on this show has given me a classic series story. It just shows you the power of the old days. Everybody's favorite of all time is from the original version of the series and doesn't take into account the last 18 years of televised, too. And then the third thing is that both of the stories you picked are older than we are.
Yes. Yeah. I love, you know, my favorite Doctor Who's, my favorite period of Doctor Who is Hartnell and Pertwee. It's just, I mean, obviously Pertwee, because I kind of remember because I grew up with it. But again, yeah, it's older than I am. And Hartnell, because I think it's just like there is no better Doctor, and there is no, like, it's almost like, I think some other author once quoted, like, you know, William Hartnell was the best Doctor, and then it kind of all downhill from there. Over the next 57 years.
I have covered both the Aztecs novelization and the Marco Polo novelization on this show in the last few months, episodes 88 and 94 respectively. And I probably said some variation of the following statement during both of those episodes, but the variety that you get in the Verity Lambert era is so much above and beyond the variety that you get even today, because...
Oh, yeah.
Even though half the stories are set on Earth, you never know what year it is going to be, and you never know what genre it is going to be. Verity Lambert is given this ridiculously tiny Lime Grove Studio D, and she says, great, this week it's going to be 12th century Holy Land fighting the Crusades. Then it's going to be an alien planet where none of the aliens are humanoid, and we're going to smear Vaseline on the lenses to make it look like outer space. And then we're going to be in a space museum, and then we're going to go and do an episode on the Empire State Building and the Mary Celeste in the same half hour. And then we're going to go to 1066, and we're going to fight the Viking invasion of England before the invasion by William the Conqueror. What other era of Doctor Who gives you all that in a six-month stretch of televised program? It's unbelievable what they tried to get away with and did.
Yeah,
and all totally. In the same ridiculously small studio.
Absolutely. Yeah, and it's funny because I recently, I probably finished last year, but I did my very first ever watch through of Doctor Who, one episode a day from the pilot episode to Survival, but continuous, which I'd never done. And it's interesting, it's one thing, I know it takes a long time because it's like 600 and however many episodes, but it's something I recommend all Doctor Who fans do, because you really start to see and understand the development of the program and how it changes over time. And that kind of wild Hartnell era, which then drifts into a very formulaic Troughton era. And then Troughton turns into, and I say this with kindness, but like a show for boys. So when you get to Pertwee after season 7, as much as I love Pertwee, it's a show for boys. Because there are some stories where there are no female cast members whatsoever, apart from maybe the, apart from the companion. And it's very much, it's a boys' show, which is kind of curious because it made me think of early Hartnell and going through that. It's like, you know, you had male and female characters, mixed cast, diverse cast, because they were just making an exciting adventure television program for the whole family, which means you include the whole family. And then later on, it kind of comes for boys. But I say that kind of not in a mean way, but as an interesting way of looking at how Doctor Who evolves. And I only got that insight by watching it in order, you know, sequential order, which was amazing. And it took probably, I think it took, well, yeah, it took 4 years because I had some gaps. Some I got stuck during some stories where it's like I could not bear to watch the next episode. So there's like a, in the Troughton era, there's like 6 week gaps between episodes because it's like I was starting to struggle. But it's good. It's a good thing to do, for sure.
That's actually the genesis of this podcast. I started doing the pilgrimage during the pandemic. I started in October 2020, and I was doing 2 episodes a night rather than one. So on the first night, October 26th, is Unearthly Child and Cave of Skulls. Next night is Forest of Fear and the Firemaker. And I had to take a couple of breaks to wait for DVDs to come out. Like I waited for the Fury from the Deep DVD, and I waited for the Season 8 Blu-ray Collection DVD, autographed by the lovely Katie Manning, who I have met. It took me 14 months to get from Unearthly Child to Survival. And I tweeted all through this, so you can see my waxing and waning enthusiasm. Six of the Troughton era is painful in spots, and it's amazing in spots because you also have the invasion and war games. But by the end of Seeds of Death and Space Pirates, I was just desperate to do something else and not watch this show for a while. And I was able to wait then for the Season 8 Blu-ray to come out and re-engage my enthusiasm. Everything between Season 7 and Season 14, the entirety of Letts and Holmes and Hinchcliffe and Terrence Dix, everything there is transcendent. And then the Graham Williams era arrives, and it is a train wreck. And to go from horror of Fang Rock to the bad production of Invisible Enemy, and you're watching all of this in a four-night stretch. It's like whiplash. That's so bad my neck still hurts. And then the joy that I get when the Eric Sayward era is finally over and we get Paradise. I used to hate Paradise Towers, but watching it in Secrets, it's gorgeous because all of a sudden the cynicism of Sayward is gone, the misogyny of Sayward is gone. Then you have this optimistic story where everybody comes together to fight the bad guys, and it's just a happy, joyful story, even though it's an adaptation of the most nihilistic novel ever written, J.G. Ballard's High Ride.
That's funny because Paradise Towers, I would have said it was my least favorite story ever. I really, 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 really hated it. And then I watched it as part of my pilgrimage. And I loved it. It was so good. It's just like all of it kind of sparkles somehow. I was kind of, it was a complete revelation.
So we've been talking a lot about how our fandom journeys are nearly identical. And of course, we have diverged at some point, other than our views on television from the 1960s and 70s. And you are now in the UK, and you are a published author. What was your transition from editing Doctor Who fanzines to becoming this established author with a very wide bookshelf?
Well, I think it was, well, I have to credit Doctor Who because that was what I was writing, so Doctor Who fan fiction. As I got to high school, I started writing stuff for like the high school magazine. Not Doctor Who fan fiction, obviously, just like stories. So I always kind of wanted to write, and I knew that I wanted to write. So I even, there was a thing in the 90s, like the New Adventures published by Virgin Publishing, you know, authors could submit proposals to those. And I did work on several. I never sent anything off. And it was the same with BBC Books that came afterwards. You know, I did several kind of outlines and synopses and sample chapters, but never sent anything off. But again, I think it was all kind of practice for writing. So it was when I, yeah, so like I came to the UK in 2006, and it's funny because like exactly the same time that I moved, there was a publisher here in the UK that had an open submission window. So again, with most main publishers, you know, you can't just send anything in. You've got to have an agent and this kind of whole process. Sometimes some of the smaller ones will do like an open submission window where like, well, anyone can send something in, even if you don't have an agent or anything. So I thought, yeah, of course I'll do that. So I actually did a proper proposal and submission. And I thought I would immediately get accepted because my work was clearly genius and it was going to be amazing. And I was going to, yeah. But obviously what happened was I got to the UK and then a few weeks later I got the rejection. Now, it wasn't like that kind of, oh my God, a rejection, I'm devastated, this is destroying everything. It was actually kind of weird because I was like, oh yeah, actually this proposal is really quite bad. If I want to do this as a job, I've got to take it seriously. And it was like this kind of switch flipped in my brain. It's like, okay, I need to take it seriously. So I, from then on, I just kind of like, okay, I'm going to do this. So I sat down and I wrote. And this is original science fiction. So although I'd love to write Doctor Who or Star Wars or whatever, you know, I was kind of realistic and was like, well, no, you have to write your own stuff first before they let you touch anything else. So I wrote manuscripts. I wrote three manuscripts, like full novel-length manuscripts. The first one just to see if I could do it, like, because I'd always written short fiction, but could I even write something that's as long as a novel? So that manuscript was finished. It was completely terrible and like just rubbish, but it proved to myself that I could get to the end of a book. So then I wrote the next one, and then I met an editor from Angry Robot, who was my first publisher. I actually met them on Twitter in about 2009, and he ended up buying the second and third books that I'd written. And then that was kind of it, and I just kind of kept going.
Amazing that 15 years ago, Twitter was actually a force for good in the world as compared to what it is now.
It was really useful because people would, in those days, hang out on Twitter because it was a good social platform for meeting people who had the same interests. So the editor, Lee Harris, like I didn't meet him because he was an editor and I wanted to sell him a book. I met him because we like the same books and the same movies and TV programs and Doctor Who and science fiction and all that kind of stuff. So he was just one of a whole community of people. It just happened that he was an editor at a really good publishing house. So yeah, completely fortuitous. And it's funny, there's a magazine here called SFX, which is a kind of monthly science fiction. And they ran a news article when I got signed up. It was like, author discovered on Twitter. And they kind of made a big deal of it, which is kind of funny because like this was 2000 and probably 10 or 11 by then. But again, it's a kind of snapshot into something which it's not that long ago, but it now feels like a whole other thing, the way everything's gone now with Twitter and social media.
In my mind, the monthly release of The New Adventures was 5 minutes ago. And yet, 30 years ago, this month is when the novel The Dimension Riders came out. So, clearly.
Well, because The Dimension Riders, in my mind, is like a very late New Adventures novel, but it's actually not. It's kind of in the middle somewhere. I don't know whether this was, again, this is this New Zealand thing where New Adventures are quite expensive and they didn't come out on the same release schedule because they were shipped to New Zealand, so they were kind of later. So I think I kind of got it all muddled up. But that's funny, the Dimension Riders is 30 years old. That's, you know.
The Dimension Riders set my brain alight. And the only, this is of course unpublished, the only new adventure that I ever tried to write was based on Rime of the Ancient Mariner, which is cited as an epigraph for the Dimension Riders. So I owe a lot to Dan Blythe, because my only new adventure, so to speak, would not exist if I had not read his book during a vacation from college, and it fired my imagination. The only thing that I ever submitted to Virgin Publishing was for the Decalogue series, their short story collections. And I got a review back from Peter Darvill Evans, the editor at the time, and the review said, not badly written, but not terribly interesting either. And to me, that was the greatest review that I've ever gotten, because it has validation while it also says it's not publishable. And my professional writing career has not really, of course, gotten much past that. So you have a lot of books that are worth discussing, but this is only an hour-long program. So I have two books in front of me, and let's talk about each of these briefly. Your most recent one that I have is your Star Wars novel, and this is Shadow of the Sith, and this is a prequel to Episode 9. I'll preface that with a question. 11 official Star Wars movies, which one is your favorite?
Probably A New Hope, actually. Just because it has everything in it. Like, because this is before Star Wars became a thing, obviously. So George Lucas kind of threw everything that he knew about filmmaking and what he wanted to do into that movie. So it's a science fiction space opera, but it's also a samurai movie, and it's also a western, and it's also a kind of swashbuckling serial, and it's also a Flash Gordon serial. It's kind of got everything mashed up. And even from Empire Strikes Back onwards, it settles down into more of a structure of what the universe is and how it all works. But that first one, because it's just this big experiment, and when you think about it, it's like no wonder people were worried about it, because it's kind of weird. Like, just if you forget about who Darth Vader is or what he means, like, just look at this guy in costume in this kind of weird skull mask and cloak, and you've got this golden droid tottering around, and you've got an old man in kind of robes. It's totally weird. And people were very worried about it. And then, of course, it turned into a huge phenomenon. But that's what I love. It's like, it is just this exciting adventure.
And yet, George Lucas is able to use the written word to spread the word of mouth about his movie, because he gets Alan Dean Foster to write the novelization, which comes out first. And he gets Roy Thomas to do the 6-part Marvel Comics adaptation, which is how I discovered Star Wars. And the Roy Thomas adaptation, even though it's based on the original rough cut and it contains characters and subplots that didn't work their way into the final movie, the Roy Thomas 6-episode comic miniseries is amazing. And for me, that's still the original Star Wars. So you have the comic and the novelization to thank for getting Star Wars out there. And then the movie takes off the way that it does, and the visuals take us into a whole other universe. What was the process for you to become a writer for the Star Wars expanded universe?
So, let me think. It was when The Force Awakens, the first trailer came out. A friend of mine, who's another writer, Chuck Wendig, we actually had the same agent as well. And we both love Star Wars. And I was like, I think I said to him, I really want to do a Star Wars book. And he's like, oh, actually, I've already got something lined up. So through him, I was introduced to the editorial team, and it was just a matter of, it sounds like the wrong kind of word, this kind of hustle, to keep hustling. But it was like, we ended up hanging out, me and the editors, at things like San Diego Comic-Con and New York Comic-Con. And again, like with Angry Robot, not specifically because I wanted to do a Star Wars book, but because I love Star Wars, and like, they were fun people to hang out with. And I was already an established writer, so you kind of got that other community of kind of publishers and editors and writers and things. And I guess eventually the opportunity came along. The first thing I did was actually a short story for the first, From a Certain Point of View, 40th anniversary anthology for A New Hope, which was 2017. That was fun. And then I did a comic kind of unrelated to the books, but IDW had a Star Wars Adventures line, which is kind of like an all-ages comic anthology series for Star Wars. So I did a story for them. And then it was actually the Stranger Things book that came next, because Stranger Things is the same publisher, the same editorial team. And because, you know, there's a million authors who want to do Star Wars, and there's only very few books per year. And I was patient. I was like, you know, I'm happy to wait. The right book comes along, the right opportunity, that's fantastic. So in the meantime, Stranger Things arrived. Like, do you want to do a Hopper prequel novel? So I was like, yeah, for sure. So I kind of did that. That was kind of it wasn't really officially, but I treated it like my audition novel, because it was going to be the same editors and the same process and everything. So I kind of made sure I, you know, hit my deadlines and did a good job, because that would obviously impact kind of doing such things in the future. I had written tie-ins previously. So Doctor Who fiction is obviously tie-in fiction, because it's based in an existing universe. You kind of come into a write in that universe. Because I'd grown up with Doctor Who and Terrence Dix and the Target novelizations, I kind of feel like I always wanted to do tie-in fiction. But I also knew that I had to establish myself as my own kind of author first. So I did, you know, original novels. But I got the opportunity to write two novels for Elementary, which was the, you know, the modern day Sherlock Holmes series of Johnny Lee Miller and Lucy Liu.
Filmed right here in Brooklyn, or they did an episode on my
blog? Exactly. Oh my goodness. That would have been cool. So the two novels for that, because again, like, this is a new thing. Can I even write a tie-in novel? Because it's a totally different kind of writing to your own stuff, because, you know, you've got your own story and your own voice to put across, but you're using characters that already exist in a universe that already exists. And more so with things like Star Wars, but like, there are people who are fans of these characters. And same with Stranger Things. It's like, they will know immediately when you get something wrong. You know, because they are the ones who have the most desire for more stories and more books and things, but are also kind of the harshest critics, because they know the property inside out and back to front and upside down. So doing Elementary was really good kind of practice. I mean, I was a fan of Elementary, and they were really pleased with how that turned out. It was, you know, it's a CBS series. They were like, this is great. So, and then I did some video game stuff, which is kind of a bit different. Dishonored, which is a trilogy of novels for the Dishonored video game series. Different kind of tie-ins, because it's computer games. But by the time it came to Stranger Things, it's like, okay, I actually know how to write a tie-in, both from the creative point of view, but also the practical point of view. Because again, tie-ins is different kind of publishing. There are deadlines upon deadlines upon deadlines. And there are millions of people, not literally, dozens of people waiting and looking at the book, and kind of, you know, there's producers and script editors and, you know, all kinds of people involved in the hierarchy of the you know, elementary or Stranger Things or Star Wars. So a lot of people, a lot of pressure. But it turns out I really like it. Like, I love doing that kind of work. And, you know, Star Wars, to me, is the kind of pinnacle. I love Star Wars. I don't think it can get much bigger than Star Wars in terms of this kind of work.
So your Stranger Things book, and I say this without hyperbole, this is one of my favorite novels of all time, and I'll tell you exactly why. It is so easy to get New York wrong. I am very possessive of New York.
Yeah.
And any book or movie or Doctor Who episode that is said here that gets it wrong, I can't see past the factual errors or the mistakes to enjoy the underlying story. So when I watched the Stephen Moffat episode, The Angels Take Manhattan, the geography is so bad that I just couldn't enjoy the story as a story. And you could say that about many other things said in New York. The research that you did for Darkness at the Edge of Town and the way that you use New York as a character in the story and the way that you are one of the few authors to realize that everybody in New York is an immigrant either from elsewhere in the U.S. or from overseas, and there's a whole range of accents and last names and cultures and attitudes. And just to look at the acknowledgments, you give acknowledgments to the Bowery Boys, which is my favorite New York podcast. Mm-hmm. And absolutely, you also give a shout out to Greg Prince and Jason Fry, who I guarantee most of my listeners will not have heard of. They are the two Mets bloggers from the Faith and Fear and Flushing blog. They are the foremost names in Mets fandom. I have a few Greg Prince books on my bookshelf in the other room. I have his autobiography about his Mets fandom over the course of 30 years. And I also have the first book he wrote summarizing the 100 best games in Mets history. So the fact that this is how I spend so much of my spare time, and you acknowledge them on the same page in your book, and I can actually see in the book. So your book is set during the New York City blackout in 1977, which is one of my earlier memories. And thanks to Greg and Jason, you were able to pinpoint the exact Mets game that was played as the blackout was happening.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, I kind of got lucky because I'd always wanted to write a story set during the blackout. And then this came along. And the other thing is, like, I love New York City. I love New York City history, you know, which is why I love the Bowery Boys. My first novel is called Empire State, and it's about a version of New York that's trapped in a kind of pocket dimension. So that, like, there's nothing exists except for Manhattan. Because I love the history and the kind of the culture and everything about it. And again, Elementary is set in New York. So I think I definitely tapped the Bowery Boys for those as well. To get things right. Like, there's a thing, like I say, tie-in fiction and characters, you've also got to get location and place. And if it's a very specific place, it's all very well to make up a planet or a, you know, a artificial creation. But like, if it's a real place, and there's got to be a reason why you set something in that particular place, then you've got to get it right. So I'm very glad you enjoyed the book.
I mean, you set the book in different boroughs, and different boroughs take place at different stages of the novel, but Hopper is living in Brownstone, Brooklyn, and then later on goes to Red Hook, which is the neighborhood just west of where I am. Did you have a specific neighborhood or a specific home address in mind for Hopper when he was living in New York?
Yeah, I think so. Everything is kind of mapped out, and routes and things. So everything, I mean, within reason, is kind of realistic. You know, things like, I think in the book there's the Rookwood Institute.
Yes.
Yeah, that's based on a real place that somehow magically kept its power during the blackout. And I think I put it in the right location. So, yeah, I was trying to get everything right. I can't remember really half of the specifics, but it's it's accurate. In as much as a kind of science fiction fantasy book is accurate.
Two specific questions I have about the Stranger Things book. Number one, one of the characters is a female psychologist or parapsychologist, and she lives in Brownstone, Brooklyn, which is where I live. It's a very specific set of interlocking neighborhoods in Brooklyn. Brooklyn Heights, Carroll Gardens, Park Slope, Windsor Terrace. So your character got her degree from Miskatonic University. So I assume that was an intentional nod to Lovecraft.
Yes. Yeah, definitely.
And one of the chapter titles is Escape to Danger. I am almost positive that is a reference to the yes. target.
Absolutely. Oh, totally. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, there's a – yeah, I do – my first Star Wars story, and from a certain point of view, first anthology, all the characters are named after characters in Robots of Death. there's Paul and Toos and et cetera. And in Shadow of the Sith, there's reference to a Sith Lord called Vord.
I noticed that later, in Shadow of the Sith. Yes, I saw Vord. I'm like, yeah. Vord? That's got to
yeah,
be
Yeah, well, right? actually, and then Kevin Scott, who's another Star Wars author, took that, and Darth Vord is then mentioned in one of his books. So, yeah, you try and sneak these things in.
That's Keys of Marin. It's not Censorite, but yes, that's one one of my favorite Hartnell eras. Keys of Marinus and Censorites are not the most beloved stories, but I'm inordinately fond of both.
Exactly. Thank you.
So let's we're coming towards the end of our time together. Let's circle back around from Star Wars and Stranger Things. But you mentioned Chuck Wendig, and I vividly recall where I was when I first read Aftermath, which came out right before Episode 7. Your book is sort of like the aftermath to Episode 9, because it's the prequel novel to Rise of Skywalker, and it builds on a lot of concepts in that book. And also, it is set on multiple locations, and it features multiple characters. How did you manage to map all that out, from Luke to Lando to your antagonist?
Well, it was kind of, in a way, it was straightforward, because obviously I knew where Luke was in the sequel trilogy, and we kind of know what happened to him in the middle with the whole, you know, tragedy of the temple and Ben and all that kind of stuff. And I also knew where Lando was in the sequel trilogy and what had happened to him. So it's a matter of like just literally taking where we left them in the original and then where they are in the sequel and kind of bridging that gap, knowing that there are very important kind of tentpole events in their lives. You know, Lando's daughter was kidnapped and then he searches for her and can't find her. So what would that do to Lando? It would really kind of transform his character. And again, Luke, it's like the book is set where his temple that he builds is kind of at its height. So it's before everything kind of goes wrong. But that allowed this kind of sense of him looking and thinking about his future and how he was navigating his course. Because again, like he's essentially a self-taught Jedi Knight. I mean, he was trained by Yoda, but he was never a Padawan, never knew the old days of the Jedi with the big temples and everything. So he's kind of doing it on his own and trying to work out what the best way is and to rebuild the Jedi Order. So it was a really good opportunity to do a character arc, which you don't often get in that kind of tie-in fiction. You know, you're very constrained usually by the parameters of wherever the story has to be set. Usually it's very specific between, you know, episodes or stories or an era. I'm just glad that people liked it. Because, you know, Luke is an important character. He's like the most important character in Star Wars. And
of course,
you know, Lando is a character that we need to see more of. So it was good to do. And I'm also aware, you know, because it was set right in the middle of that period in the Star Wars timeline where there's nothing really. There's very few other bits of story. I had such freedom to tell the story that I wanted. So I really made it like, I imagined it like this is episode 6.5. This is
Oh wow.
This is a big cinematic movie. It's a Star Wars movie. So if I was a fan going to watch a Star Wars movie, what would I want to see? Well, there's got to be all kinds of certain beats and chases and fights and explosions and intrigue and all this kind of stuff. And they kind of just managed to cram that into book form somehow.
And not to give too much away, but you also have Rey's parents in here.
Oh, yeah.
Characters mapped out for you, was there a Bible or did you invent them or characterize them on your own?
No, completely my own creations. They didn't even have names. You know, we see, they're in The Rise of Skywalker for like 2 seconds. Jodie Comer and the actor whose name I can never remember, who plays the father. But, and I say that because Jodie Comer is one of my favorite actors. And like when I saw her in the cinema when I went to see it, I just remember going, oh my goodness, I didn't realize that she was in Star Wars. So to be able to turn her into a fully fledged character with a name and a story and a history was really amazing. And this is the great thing. It's like, I'm a Star Wars fan as well as a writer, so I got to contribute actual Star Wars mythos to the canon of Star Wars, which is amazing. So yeah, Dathan and Miramir, Rey's parents.
So to come back to Doctor Who, this is nominally part 3 of my episode on the 5 Doctors. And I've already aired episodes 1 and 2 a little while back. You've already told us your favorite stories of all time over the last 60 years are Doctor Who and the Silurians and Marco Polo. But I'm asking this question as part of this 3-part Five Doctors special. Can you make an argument that Five Doctors is the greatest Doctor Who story of all time?
Well, it's funny because of all the stories that I watched when I went through my in-order viewing pilgrimage, the Five Doctors was the one that I watched it all in one 90-minute stretch. That was the only story where, as soon as it finished, I thought I could watch it again straight away. Like I could just put it on. Now, even Marco Polo and Silurians didn't have that effect. So I'd have to say there is definitely something about the Five Doctors that makes it special. And it's one of those things where kind of everything comes together. Like, it's a good story, but it's not the greatest story. It's a good production, but it's not the greatest production. It's like good actors, but they're not the best actors. There's so much of it that works, and then so much of it that doesn't work. And it's funny because the novelization is a kind of interesting thing because it's very much a very literal transcript of adaptation of the story, and it really shows the weaknesses more than it shows the strengths. So the plot holes and inconsistencies start to come out in the novelization, which you can miss that in the TV episode because it's this, it's a fun adventure. It does exactly what it's supposed to do, which is bring characters that you love. And, of course, back in 1983, this is before VHS and before repeats. There's some repeats in the UK. But, like, if you missed an episode, you'd missed it. And, if you grew up with John Pertwee, that was 10 years ago. So I think the nostalgia factor for people at the time must have been enormous. So it does everything it needs to do. And I kind of, I like the TV episode more than the book, but the book is like, it's Terrence Dix doing his job. It has some weirdness in the book, but
the book was timed to come out before the episode aired on TV. So he has very little time to write this. And of course, writing the episode in the first place, all before November 23rd, 1983, if the book had maybe come out 2 years later, he could have given us a more expanded edition. But obviously, it's not the best of the targets for that reason. But for you, what are the foundational targets? What are the books where you go back and say, ah, my writing style is inspired in part by this bit of writing from the 1970s or 80s?
Yeah. The Abominable Snowmen, The Green Death, Oh, Disney of the Daleks. And then later, Marco Polo and the Aztecs. And then, it's tricky. Things like Deadly Assassin, Hand of Fear. The thing about Disney of the Daleks is this used to be a point of pride for myself for some reason. I could read that book in a single sitting. I could sit down and read it, and I'd be done in between an hour and an hour and a half. And I was, this is from when I was probably nine or ten. That was like this huge achievement. I could get like a t-shirt printed saying that I read Disney of the Daleks in one day. This is like, it's, I don't know, it's just a really good book.
It was actually one of my first. I got my first three Target novelizations on the same day in January 1985. That was my salary for babysitting my kid sister after school and on weekends. So my father took me to the bookshop, and I stood there with my head cocked to the side for a good 20 minutes looking at two full shelves of nothing but Target novels.
Oh, my goodness.
And I ended up walking away with Doctor Who and the Cybermen, which is the novelization of the moon base, and The Invasion of Time, and Destiny of the Daleks. So I got a Cyberman story, a Gallifrey story, and a Dalek story in my very first sitting. 2 weeks later, I went back and I got Unearthly Child, The Demons, and The Visitation. So all of a sudden, I had all five Doctors that I knew about in my first six books, and I had some pretty enormous tentpole stories in there. So yeah, for me, Destiny is my very first day reading Doctor Who novelizations. Destiny was one of the ones that I read. So very happy to hear you say that.
It's funny, it's probably, it's Terence Dix, but it's kind of almost the inverse of The Five Doctors, because it's probably a novelization that's better than the TV episodes, even though the novel doesn't expand at all. It's, again, quite a literal adaptation, but there's something about it which just kind of makes it a good read.
And it's certainly one of his shortest. I think that it's actually barely 100 pages of text, considering that the book starts on page 107. Sorry, starts on page 7 and finishes on page 111, one of his shortest books. This is perhaps not a fair question, but if you had been there in the 70s and 80s and 90s for W.H. Allen or Target, and they had said to you, Adam, we want you to write one of these brand new Target novelizations, which one would you, which story would you have picked to novelize yourself had you been there back in the day?
Well, I would have done The Demons or The Mutants. The Demons is one of my favorite stories. It's in the top five. And I think The Mutants, because it's a strange story. Like, it, people tend not to like it, and I always think that I don't like it. And then when I watch it, it's really good. And then I forget. I think, oh, it's not very good. And then I watch it again. I'm like, no, this is actually quite a good story. I don't know why it's like that, but the novel, I haven't actually read the novelization for 30 years, but that would probably be my pick. It's a kind of, it's the Dave Martin and Bob Baker stuff, which is weird because, like, they're the two writers where I don't understand why they were hired every time, because, well, apparently they wrote these stories which were so outrageously expensive and fantastical and not like Doctor Who, and then the script editor had to rewrite everything to make it work. And that happened every single time. Just like, why did they keep hiring these two writers? And in fact, the TV stories are not very good. You know, The Claws of Axos is actually pretty terrible. But The Mutants, for some reason, I guess everything came together.
Yeah, I was never crazy about Claws of Axos, but when you read the Terrence novelization, which includes a lot of scenes that were deleted for reasons of time, you can see that it's a very political story, and these writers have a lot to say about the small-minded make Britain great again mentality, and there's a lot to say about greed and international relations. Terrence, even though he always says on the commentary tracks, if you want to send a message, get Western Union – he was a very political and a very dialed in writer, and he loved these thinly veiled political stories. So when he writes the novelizations for Bob Baker and Dave Martin, everything jumps off the page, and it's a lot more exciting when he does it than perhaps when they do it.
Yeah.
So that's pretty much our conversation about your favorite Doctor Who stories, your own original novels, your experience with the Targets, your experiences in fandom. Is there anything else you have coming up in the near future that you might want to promote for us?
Things I can't talk about.
I can imagine.
Which is like very anticlimactic, but yeah, you just have to keep watching.
But that means you have contracts signed, you have NDAs, and at some point I'm sure there'll be a very exciting revelation.
Yeah, and in fact, yeah, I'm doing something tomorrow actually, which is very exciting, which I can't talk about. So we can look back in a few years and pinpoint, this is the evening before I go and do this exciting thing, and then I can tell you all about it.
Well, if you are ever back out at New York Comic Con, I will treat you to a great slice of Brooklyn pizza here in Hopperland.
Oh, amazing. Yeah, definitely.
Well, Adam, thank you so much for joining me and sharing your experiences with us. Have a great New York week, whether you live here or not.
Thank you so much.
Always wanted to say that.
Oh, brilliant. Amazing.
Have a great night.
Thank you very much.
After power was restored to New York City in July 1977, and after the conclusion of the possibly fictional events portrayed in the Stranger Things novel Darkness on the Edge of Town, the Mets and the Cubs finally resumed their game in September 1977, just about 2 months later. The Mets actually came back to tie the game in the bottom of the seventh inning, but in the top of the eighth, the Mets' pitching and defense fell apart, which it so often did between 1977 and 1983, and the Mets ended up losing the game 5-2. That was not their only defeat of the year. At the end of the season, the Mets found themselves in last place with only 64 wins, worst total in their division. It was not until 1984 that the Mets once again became a team to be reckoned with in baseball's National League. By 1984, Detective Hopper had already left New York and moved back home to Hawkins, Indiana, where he became a vital part of the Stranger Things universe. But that is a story for another day, a story for another media franchise, and a story for somebody else's podcast. If you want to hear the results of the Mets game in 1977, as of 3 days before the release of this podcast, the radio broadcast of that game is now available on YouTube, including the brief delay in the game caused by the blackout, and including the rousing conclusion 2 months later, which I have, of course, already spoiled the ending for you. But if you want to hear what happens when the lights go out in New York City in the bad old days of the 1970s, the audio is there for you to listen to. We will be back next week on Doctor Who Literature with an ongoing anniversary special talking about a topic from the last 60 years of Doctor Who and what we are doing to celebrate and commemorate that 60th anniversary here in the year 2023. That's next time on Doctor Who Literature. Thank you for joining me on another episode of the Doctor Who Literature podcast. This episode was written, produced, and edited by me. Our producers are David Barsky, Jim Sangster, and yours truly. Our logo was designed by Jim Sangster. Special thanks to my special guest, Adam Christopher. This podcast can be found on most of your podcast apps of choice. You can find all past episodes at podcasters.spotify.com/pod/show/Doctor Who Lit. It really helps if you rate 5 stars and subscribe. You can find me on Blue Sky and Twitter and Mastodon at Doctor Who Novels. That's Dr. Who Novels. You can find me on email at Doctor Who Literature. That's Dr. Who Literature, gmail.com. Please drop me a line with your comments, questions, and suggestions. Thank you for listening, and whatever you do, keep turning the pages.
Doctor Who Podcast Network.